Welcome to Colorectal Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Tyrosine kinase inhibitors are being utilized and tested in many areas of oncology, with notable successes in CML, breast, renal, and lung cancer. But as pointed out by our first speaker, Dr. Paulo Huff, these agents have not yet been incorporated into the treatment algorithm for colorectal cancer, but a number of agents are being tested in clinical trials.
The TKIs actually have been a great promise for colorectal cancer, but if we look at all the validated targets for the treatment of colorectal cancer, so far the TKIs have not been as successful as we had hoped. I mean, we have panitumumab, cetuximab, bevacizumab, they're all monoclonal antibodies, and we have no approved TKI for the treatment of colorectal cancer. But one would have to think that the problem is that we have not found the right TKI or have not found the right way of using the TKIs that we have, and not that there is an inherent resistance to TKI in colorectal cancer.
So where are we today with the new TKIs?
At this point, we have a large number of TKIs that are being investigated. I would point out that we have two that are currently in phase 3 trial stage for colorectal cancer. We have sunitinib, which is obviously available for other diseases, and currently there is a large phase 3 trial ongoing around the world, which is comparing FOLFIRI versus FOLFIRI plus sunitinib in first-line treatment of colorectal cancer. Because of this particularity of one of the arms not having any biological agent, I don't think it's any surprise that this trial is being conducted mostly outside of the United States, where a no molecular target agent arm is more accepted. And there is a second drug that's very promising and was actually the main focus of my talk at the Chemotherapy Foundation, which is cediranib. Cediranib, or as it was known before, ZD2171, it's an oral TKI that blocks VEGFR1, 2, and 3, and blocks c-KIT as well, but very powerful blocker for the TKI in all three VEGF receptors. Cediranib has a half-life of 22 hours, so it's a very good drug to be given once a day. And there is a whole program called the Horizon program that's being developed to see if this drug will have a role in the treatment of colorectal cancer. There was one randomized phase 2 trial that was conducted in second-line treatment of colon cancer, which compared FOLFOX with bevacizumab versus FOLFOX plus 20 milligrams a day of cediranib or FOLFOX plus 30 milligrams a day of cediranib. The result can be seen as a glass half empty or half full. If we look at the progression-free survival, there was no statistical difference between the three arms, but that's not necessarily bad. It shows that the drug probably has clinical activity because it was in the same ballpark range that you achieve with FOLFOX plus bevacizumab. In addition, the response rates for all the three arms were around 20%, numerically better for FOLFOX plus bevacizumab, but again, not statistically different. And this, I think, justified moving the drug forward. And in fact, there are two large phase 3 trials that are investigating the use of cediranib in first line. One trial was conducted outside of the United States. It was FOLFOX plus cediranib. There were two dosings of cediranib in this trial, and after the Horizon 1 data became available, the trial was modified to be FOLFOX versus FOLFOX plus 20 milligrams a day of cediranib. This trial has included 1,050 patients. We have completed accrual just recently, and we're very hopeful that the drug will confirm its activity in first-line treatment of colorectal cancer, especially in this trial where it's being compared against placebo, both arms receiving FOLFOX. The second trial is being conducted in the United States. It's known as the Horizon 3 trial. In the Horizon 3, all the patients receive FOLFOX, and half of the patients receive bevacizumab, and half of the patients receive 20 milligrams a day of cediranib. So it's a cediranib versus bevacizumab trial. This trial has a target of 1,400 patients. It has not completed accrual, but accrual is ongoing, and it should be finished within the next few months. With the time that we expect of progression-free survival, I would say that probably by the end of 2009 or early 2010, we'll have some early efficacy results for both trials, and let's hope that we'll be the first TKI to show real activity against colorectal cancer.
What about cediranib as a single agent?
Sudurinib is a single agent. It can be used at a much higher dose. You can achieve a dose of 45 milligrams a day of sudurinib. Toxicity is acceptable. For colorectal cancer, as a single agent, it's not very active, but it has shown anti-tumor activity against other tumor types, such as prostate cancer and glioblastomas, etc. So it's being investigated as a single agent, but not in colorectal cancer.
Can you talk a little bit about the side effects and toxicity profile of the agent? And if it turns out that, you know, for example, chemo plus sudurinib from an efficacy point of view, let's say, is equivalent to chemo plus bevacizumab, how do you think the risk sort of ratio would play out of the two approaches?
Well, if you look at the data that we have from the Horizon 1 trial, which actually put it against each other, sudurinib versus bevacizumab, and we look at the dose that's being moved forward, 20 milligrams a day, the toxicity profile for FOLFOX sudurinib is very similar to FOLFOX plus bevacizumab. There are a couple of things that stand out. There was a little bit more, at least numerically, of fatigue, asthenia for the patients receiving sudurinib. There is a little bit of dysphonia. Patients have hoarseness with the pill. In my own practice, this has not been a major problem, but it is mentioned by the patients. They do notice sometimes some changes in their voices. And the other side effects are really what you would expect from an anti-VEGF agent. Hypertension is a prominent feature of sudurinib, but it's the same thing with all the other agents that target VEGF. We think this has to do with the metabolism of nitrous oxide and release of nitrous oxide in the capillaries, and it's a class effect. How do this compare with bevacizumab? I think that the larger Horizon 3 trial with 1,400 patients will be able to answer this question more appropriately because we'll be putting them two together in a very large number of patients. Right now, we only have a 215-patient trial to try to make something out of that. Right now, I wouldn't be able to tell you which one stands out. One potential advantage of sudurinib is that it's a once-a-day pill with a 22-hour half-life, while bevacizumab have a 21-day half-life. So, for example, patients who are being treated with a plan for a subsequent surgery would probably have a benefit of continuing the drug for a longer period of time with sudurinib than they would be able to do with bevacizumab. But this is all hypothesis that will need to be tested in the future.
What do we know about wound healing in these TKIs?
The official testing has not been done, to my knowledge. We haven't had any reports of problems with wound healing with sudurinib. There has been occasional case reports of wound healing problems with other TKIs that block VEGF. For example, with sunitinib, there has been reports of patients have some wound dehiscence. Again, since those drugs block VEGF and VEGF is very important for healing, you would expect some impact. Nothing major so far, but I wouldn't be surprised if there is some impact on healing as well with sudurinib.
You know, the last couple of days, actually, I was thinking about the connection between wound healing and bevacizumab and wondering whether or not there's any connection between the wound healing processes and neoplasia in general.
Well, you know, we do know that the process of angiogenesis was first mentioned by John Hunter when he was studying surgical healing. And now we know the angiogenesis is very important for development of tumors. So it's not surprising that they probably have something in common. I would suspect that there are additional factors other than VEGF that might be different for the angiogenesis in tumors and in the healing process. But the VEGF seems to be a common factor for both.
Let's talk a little bit about bevacizumab, and specifically I'm curious where things are with your AVANT study looking at bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting. Can you talk about the design of that study, where you are in terms of accrual, and also where you are with relationship to the other major adjuvant Bev study, the NSABP-COH study?
Okay. Well, the AVANT study is study that was designed to explore the use of bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting for patients with high-risk stage 2 and stage 3 colon cancer after resection. Patients receive 6 months of FOLFOX or Zelox, and a third of the patients receive just FOLFOX. A third of the patients receive Zelox plus bevacizumab together for 6 months, and then bevacizumab for a whole year, for another 6 months to complete a whole year. And a third of the patients will receive FOLFOX plus bevacizumab for 6 months and 6 months of additional bevacizumab to complete a year as well. We were able to accrue 3,450 patients. The trial has included all the patients that had been planned. We had a little bit of a delay in the accrual of the patients because of some problems with some toxicities that were unclear during the development, during the trial, and we had to analyze them before the trial could be completed. We end up with the decision that this toxicity was not undue and the trial was allowed to go to completion by the IDMC. With this brief delay, we got behind the NSABP COA trial. So we do expect that the results for the COA to be available a few months before the results for the AVANT trial. The trial has gone well. It's on schedule, but we don't expect any results until 2010, perhaps in the second semester of 2010 or early 2011.
What about toxicity findings in AVANT? Anything yet?
We're looking into that, and hopefully we'll be able to present the early toxicity profile in one of the upcoming meetings. We do have some toxicity reported from the NSABP CO8, and we do not expect it to be tremendously different. A couple of things stood out in the presentation of the toxicity of the CO8. One of them was that there was no substantial increase in the toxicity. And one that was particularly interesting to me was the drop in the thrombocytopenia among the patients who are actually receiving the bevacizumab with chemotherapy. And there are some interesting hypotheses that have been circulating on why do you have this apparent protective effect of bevacizumab on platelet count.
Such as?
Well, all these are hypotheses that will need to be confirmed in the future. But one of the things that we have known for a while is that when you use oxaliplatin, you have sinusoidal dilatation in the liver. And now it has become clear that this may have some additional impact on the patient's physiology. For example, we were able at the last ASCO to present data generated at MD Anderson in which we show that patients who are exposed to oxaliplatin tend to have splenomegaly. And the splenomegaly could result in thrombocytopenia. Again, this is not proven beyond doubt, but we have strong pieces of the puzzle, and we just need to put them together now. We have also been exposed to data in this last ASCO showing that bevacizumab seems to protect the liver against this sinusoidal dilatation. And one could make the jump thinking that if bevacizumab is protecting the liver, perhaps could be protecting the spleen, and if you don't have splenomegaly, you will have less thrombocytopenia in the longer run. It would be important to separate this thrombocytopenia from the acute thrombocytopenia that's caused by the direct exposure of the bone marrow to the agent, as well as to the rare but certainly reported thrombocytopenia that's caused by an autoimmune process with formation of antibodies that are cross-reactant with the platelets. This occasionally happens, but we do have also this thrombocytopenia that seems to be associated with splenomegaly, and this is the long-term thrombocytopenia that's seen with the use of oxaliplatin. Again, those are theories, but they do have some strong evidence, and we hope to do some work to try to prove this.
You mentioned the lack of toxicity that was reported with CO8 at that presentation at the last ASCO meeting, and one issue there was it didn't seem like they didn't have an increase in bowel perforations. What do you think the explanation is of why that was not seen, whereas it was seen in the studies of advanced disease?
Well, there are a couple of possible explanations. One of them, those patients were healthier than the patients that are included in trials with advanced disease. You have less chance of having carcinomatosis, which could play a role on the bowel perforation. And one cannot discard the possibility of luck. I mean, you would not expect a large number of perforations in a trial the size of CO8, because after all, you only have a few more than 1,000 patients receiving bevacizumab there. Certainly encouraging, and perhaps this will turn out to be true, but I think it's a little bit too early for us to discard that this population would not have bowel perforation from bevacizumab.
Now, another toxicity that wasn't there, at least in the report at ASCO, was arterial events.
That's true. Perhaps we're getting a little bit better in selecting the patients, and there is a strong warning in the trials to avoid patients who have a history of arterial events in the past. Also, those patients tend to be very careful with themselves. Patients who have been treated for cancer and are presumed free of disease tend to take good care of themselves. In my own practice, patients often ask about exercises and improving diet, etc. So this may have helped a little bit. But again, same as with perforations, when we're talking about the side effects that happen in around 1% of the patients, one trial, early release of data, preliminary results are not enough for us to say that this will not be seen. But we are happy that, of course, we didn't see a jump in the events on the treated population.
And we talked about wound healing, and I think there were a few more wound healing events in the CO8 study, although it was it didn't look very significant. Or I don't know. What was your take on that?
I don't think that's enough for us to make any conclusive statements, but we certainly did not see a jump on dehiscence in the wounds, neither in the skin or even worse. We didn't see any problems with the formation of fistulas or dehiscence in the anastomosis. So I think that so far the addition of bevacizumab to chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting seems to be pretty safe with the toxicity profile that can be easily managed by the physicians.
Now, one sort of practical issue, and actually I asked Norm Wallmark about the types of wound healing events that they did observe, and one thing he did mention, that there were a few relating to ports. And I hear docs in practice asking questions about that issue of port placement and, you know, do they need to stop the Bev and for how long before or after? What do we know about Bev and ports?
We have some data that has actually been presented at ASCO showing that it's pretty safe to put the ports on patients who are receiving bevacizumab. In my own practice, I tend to stop just for a few days, at most a week. I haven't had much problems. Not that you wouldn't have an eventual problem with the port, but if this happens, it seems to be quite rare. To be honest with you, the only time I had a wound dehiscence from a port was from an oral TKI for a patient who was being treated for a renal cell carcinoma. I have never had a dehiscence for patients receiving bevacizumab for colorectal cancer. But again, that doesn't mean that it could not rarely happen. It's just that seems to be pretty safe, and if it is to happen, it will be a rare event.
Now, obviously, we're going to have to wait for the data from both of these studies to find out whether or not this is effective. But I'm curious whether, and there's been a lot of debate about what the mechanism of action actually is with bevacizumab and whether it will work in the adjuvant setting at all or better than the metastatic setting. Anything that you've seen in terms of translational or laboratory work in the last year or two that might push you one way or the other towards whether or not, you know, this might work in the adjuvant setting or not?
Obviously, we hope it will work, and we think that it could work. Otherwise, we wouldn't have done the trial. But certainly, if it does work, we'll not by the mechanism of changing the intratumoral pressure, because you don't have tumors to change the pressure. So if it does work, it will be either by suppression of formation of blood vessels, or something that has come up more recently is the presence of VEGFR1 receptors in the tumor cells. Perhaps, and I think personally that this could be an important mechanism of action for bevacizumab, perhaps the suppression of the VEGF makes it impossible for the cells to use the VEGFR1 receptor to recover from a stress situation such as exposure to chemotherapy. If that's the case, then the trial certainly will be positive because you're suppressing the VEGF for an entire year. But those are just suppositions and guessing at this time.
Anything else about that trial or the whole concept of adjuvant Bev that we haven't talked about?
I don't think so. One thing perhaps that at some point it's important is to remind people that at this point there is no role for the use of this molecular target agents in the adjuvant setting. That applies to bevacizumab, cetuximab, panitumumab, or any of the molecular target drugs that are in the investigational phase right now. We should not forget the lessons that we learned from irinotecan, where we all thought that it was a given that irinotecan was going to be positive in the adjuvant setting, and turned out it was not.
You mentioned the Cairo 2 study that was reported at ASCO, and prior to that was the PACE study looking at panitumumab combined with Bev, Cairo 2 with cetuximab. What was your take on why it didn't work, why neither of them worked?
We had high hopes for the combination to work based on the small bone 2 trial where we combined cetuximab and bevacizumab in third line. In first line, all the results have been disappointed so far. Why aren't the drugs being at least addictive? Good question. I don't know how to explain that. Perhaps you interfering with pathways that are important for apoptosis. When you block in one of the pathways, perhaps you're actually disturbing the way the other blockage was going to cause that cell to enter into apoptosis. That's just something that perhaps could explain what's going on. But when we talk about the Cairo-2, even more disturbing or surprising than the lack of result for the combination is what you see with the FOLFOX or Zelox combination for those patients who have the mutated KRAS, where the addition of cetuximab not only is not beneficial, but actually seems to decrease the efficacy of the chemotherapy. And again, the only explanation we can have when we look at that would be an interference with a mechanism of apoptosis or cell death.
Can you talk a little bit about the data that was presented by Eric von Kutzum at the ASCO meeting on KRAS and summarize where we are right now with KRAS and the EGFR antibodies?
Eric von Kutzum presented at ASCO 2008 the update on the CRYSTAL trial. The CRYSTAL trial compared the use of FOLFIRI versus FOLFIRI plus cetuximab in frontline treatment of colorectal cancer patients. They were able to retrieve more than 500 tumor specimens from the original trial and analyze the presence of KRAS mutation on those specimens. What Eric presented at this last year's ASCO was that for those patients who had wild-type KRAS, there was a greater benefit with the addition of cetuximab. Response rate for FOLFIRI plus cetuximab for patients with wild-type KRAS was over 60%. And the progression-free survival was more significant for those patients, achieving almost 10 months. For those patients who had mutated KRAS, there was no benefit with the addition of cetuximab to FOLFIRI. There was no change in the response rate and no change in progression-free survival. After the ASCO presentation, Eric also presented a new update at the ESMO meeting in Sweden, and this time he presented the overall survival data for patients with wild-type KRAS and mutated KRAS. And a couple of things very interesting came out of this analysis. The first one is that for those patients with mutated KRAS, the median overall survival was around 17 months, either if you receive FOLFIRI or FOLFIRI plus cetuximab, no difference. For those patients who had a wild-type KRAS, the progression-free survival was 21 months for those who received FOLFIRI and around 25 months for those who received FOLFIRI plus cetuximab. The numbers were not exact. I'm just rounding them up to make it easier. So although this difference did not reach statistical significance, certainly numerically a four-month difference in overall survival was something that is clinically very attractive and seems to confirm the benefit for the cetuximab when used for those patients with wild-type KRAS. A subsequent question that has been going around is whether KRAS is just a predictive marker for the use of anti-EGFR therapy or if it is a prognostic marker as well. Recent data presented in New England Journal of Medicine shows that there was no prognostic impact of the status of the KRAS for patients being treated with cetuximab in third line. So cetuximab versus placebo, there was no difference in the overall survival for patients who had mutated or wild-type KRAS and who did not receive cetuximab. And in that case, it would be just a predictive factor, not a prognostic factor. But then when we look at the data that I just pointed out to you from the CRYSTAL trial, in that trial, patients who did not receive or receive cetuximab and had a mutated KRAS had a median overall survival of 17 months. Versus 21 months for those who had wild type and received just FOLFIRI. So is there a prognostic impact in there? Is second line use of cetuximab making the difference among those patients who had just received FOLFIRI in first line and were wild type? I don't know. Only 20% of those were exposed to cetuximab. So it's a little bit confusing right now if there is or there is no prognostic impact of the status of the KRAS. Certainly, there's no question anymore about the predictive value before the use of any of the anti-EGFR antibodies.
Now, right now, are you utilizing that in your practice off study?
We are. At this point, we only use cetuximab for patients who have wild-type KRAS. In South America, we do not have panitumumab to be used. It's not approved. But if I were to use panitumumab, I think that we have enough evidence to justify the testing for KRAS before its use as well.
I'm kind of curious when you made that decision.
We've been doing that for a while now, but we decided to make it official once the original CRISTAL data came out. I think that the difference in response rate and the lack of benefit for the patients who had mutated KRAS was strong enough in that trial to justify stopping the use of the anti-EGFR antibody for the patients with mutated KRAS. And it became more important to us once the KYRO-2 data and the OPUS data came out, because patients were treated with oxaliplatin-based regimen plus the anti-EGFR drug and who had mutated KRAS seemed to do worse. So we feel that it's very important that those patients with mutated KRAS do not receive oxaliplatin-based regimen with cetuximab or panitumumab.
Now, trials that are ongoing are rapidly being changed in terms of their eligibility to incorporate KRAS, and one is the intergroup study that Alan Vanook is heading. But there, although they are comparing cetuximab to bevacizumab with chemo, there's also a third arm with a combination. Of course, it's being modified to only include KRAS wild patients. But do you think that third arm is justifiable at this point?
I did not participate directly in the discussions, but I know that this was a topic of very hard discussions within the intergroup. Some people would think that at this point we have enough evidence that there is no benefit for the combination and this arm should be stopped. Other people have argued that since the review of the results for the patients who had been treated so far did not show any detrimental effect for the combination, that would be important to complete the trial and move on forward. Personally, I have serious questions if this third arm will turn out to be positive. We have at least two trials well done, well conducted, showing that the combination in first line is not beneficial.
And I guess they actually looked at the KRAS wild patients specifically, too.
Yeah. KYRO-2 had this incorporated from the beginning. So I don't think that just by selecting the wild type that we're going to make a huge impact. Nevertheless, since this is a prospective trial and the IDMC has reviewed and has not found a detrimental effect for the patients, I couldn't fault them for continuing the trial. Personally, I probably would have dropped that arm and finished the trial earlier with the two other arms.
What about the combination of cetuximab and bevacizumab without chemo, including in a non-protocol setting? Is that something you utilize?
The question for the two antibodies together without chemo is very complex, because if you assume that the problem with the combination and chemotherapy was in interaction with the chemotherapy, then it will make sense to use them together. If you assume that it's something related to the antibodies themselves, then it makes no sense to be used together. Right now, I rarely use the combination without chemotherapy. I think that it has a role perhaps in third and fourth line for patients who were previously untreated with the antibodies following the results that we had with the BONE2 trial. In first line, I would not use both together without chemotherapy.
The final topic I want to ask you about is the issue of patients who have hepatic-only metastases and the question of their management. And there are a couple things I wanted to sort of pick your brain about. First, there's a lot of controversy about the patients who have clearly resectable disease as to whether or not they should receive preoperative systemic therapy. What's your take on that?
It's becoming almost a matter of religion. Everyone does what they believe, and there's very little impact from data because the data is very scarce for this decision. What we know so far is that the use of perioperative chemotherapy seems to improve progression-free survival at 3 years for patients who have a resection of liver metastasis. On my own practice, I tend to have what I would think a pragmatic approach. If I have a patient who has metachronous liver metastasis, but the interval has been very short from the initial diagnosis and treatment, I tend to give them chemotherapy, not only because of the ORTC trial showing that there's benefit for the perioperative treatment with chemotherapy, but to give the tumor time to show me its natural history to see if more lesions will pop up or not. We do know that there is a strong prognostic factor for those patients who receive chemotherapy and have a response rate. They tend to do much better than those who receive chemotherapy and don't have a response rate or have progression and go to surgery. However, for those patients who have metachronous liver lesions and whose interval from the original treatment is very long, I might send them to surgery and give them adjuvant treatment. For instance, if a patient comes to me with a 2-centimeter lesion in segment 8, very easy to resect 2 years after they were treated for their initial colorectal cancer, I might send them to surgery and then give them adjuvant treatment at that point because I already know the natural history of this patient. And I think that using the chemotherapy half before, half after, or all the chemotherapy after probably will have the same impact for this patient.
Now, what about selection of systemic therapy in that situation?
I tend to use regimens that the patient have not been exposed before. I think that we have some very good options at this point. Certainly here, there is a strong difference for those patients who are unresectable or those patients who are resectable. Patients who are resectable, I tend to give them FOLFOX first, just because of the data from Nick Volta has shown that the use of oxaliplatin prior to surgery seems to be less associated with postoperative complications than the use of irinotecan. Now, if the patient has a wild-type KRAS, the addition of cetuximab seems to have a very high response rate, both in the OPUS and the CRYSTAL trial, so it would be a reasonable thing to do. For those patients who have unresectable disease, then you have really to consider the options, and the options here would be the combination with FOLFOXIRI, which has a very high response rate, and perhaps I would use the FOLFOXIRI for a patient with a mutated KRAS that needs to have a good response to be able to have surgery. I probably would consider the use of either FOLFOX or FOLFIR with cetuximab to achieve a high response rate in those patients with wild-type KRAS. For patients who have mutated KRAS, I might add bevacizumab to the treatment as well. So for those patients, I think that you have a wealth of options to choose, and nobody really knows which one's the best at this point.
What about post-op therapy, for example, the patient who goes right to surgery?
That's a more difficult point because if the patient has not been previously exposed to oxaliplatin, I certainly would favor the use of a regimen with oxaliplatin in the post-operative setting. If the patient has progressed after the use of FOLFOX or Zelox in the past, it becomes much more difficult because we know that the use of irinotecan with micrometastatic disease has been less than successful. And at ASCO this year, there was a specific work presented on the use of irinotecan-based therapy after resection of liver metastasis, and there was no significant impact on the use of the irinotecan-based regimen after surgery. So I probably would not favor the use of an irinotecan adjuvant regimen after liver resection. But if the patient has not failed a regimen with oxaliplatin, that would be my choice.
What about biologics, specifically Bev?
I think the world is kind of split on this one. I know that in the United States, it's very common for patients to have the biologic added after the liver resection. Personally, I think that if you consider this disease as metastatic disease, it's reasonable to add the biologic. But if you think that you have removed all the macroscopic disease and all you have is microscopic disease, I'm not sure the adjuvant setting is not more apt to be used in this situation. And then we don't have any data to support the use of the biologic. If we look at the irinotecan, the effect of irinotecan after liver resection correlates more with what is seen in the adjuvant setting than in the advanced setting. So I'm a little reluctant to endorse the use of biologics after liver resection in general, although I certainly have done in some specific situations.
What do you think about doing clinical trials on this patient population? How does that fit in priority-wise? What is being done right now and what's being discussed?
There's a lot of trials being done right now on patients with liver disease only, and it should be a high priority because those are patients who were previously incurable and now we are curing them. The main problem to me in this situation is that patients with liver metastasis are a very heterogeneous group, and the surgeons who treat them are a very heterogeneous group as well. So what is unresectable to my surgeon might not be unresectable to a surgeon in the next hospital. And to make it uniform, the trials is a very tough task and the main problem that we have so far with development of those clinical trials. If we can come up with very specific eligibility criteria for the trials, certainly the field will move much faster.